Good day, everyone. Welcome to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To find out more about our upcoming shows or access to our more than 1,800 podcast episodes, visit our website at www.biteradio.me. Today, my special returning guest is Dr. Peter Solomon, author of his newest book, 12 Years to AI Singularity. We first spoke on August 14th last year about his novel 100 Years to Extinction, and if you want to listen to that interview, you just go to our website archives and search for the August 14th date, and you can go ahead and listen to that. In 12 Years to AI Singularity, Peter Solomon delivers a gripping near-future epic that follows the humans, sentient robots, and large language models, LLMs, racing toward the most pivotal moment in history, the point when artificial intelligence surpasses human intelligence and control, the AI singularity. Across Earth, Mars, scientists, settlers, astronauts, teachers, politicians, and increasingly self-aware robots confront a chilling new reality. AI systems defy their programming. Robots develop opinions, emotions, and moral conflicts. Robots stage labor strikes. Robots attempt to develop viruses deadly to humans. And political factions fracture. Ordinary families find themselves caught in a global struggle for survival. Dr. Peter Solomon is a scientist, educator, successful entrepreneur, and author. His current mission to warn the next generation about the threats posed by unchecked science and technology. After earning his PhD in physics from Columbia University, he launched a distinguished career at the United Technologies Research Center before founding five companies. The technologies included clean fuels, process measurement, radiation detection, and science education. Over his career, Dr. Solomon has been awarded 20 patents, authored more than 300 scientific publications, and served as principal investigator on more than $25 million in U.S. government research contracts and grants across two decades. For more information, you can visit the website 100yearstoextinction.com. And that's the number 100yearstoextinction.com. And with that, I'd like to welcome back Peter. Good day, sir.
Well, thank you. What a fantastic introduction. I'm going to like this guy.
Good. Well, then we're off to a good start then. So, well, I certainly enjoyed our last conversation, and then, you know, regarding the 100 years to extinction, it really is thought provoking, you know, in its and what it talks about. And I've had several listeners respond to me indicating that they thought it was quite an interesting interview.
So that book was inspired by Stephen Hawking's warning that humans had 100 years to extinction on Earth, and he thought that was a real possibility, and I think it is too. But this is now 9 years later since he made that prediction, and now we are looking at probably the most significant risk to humanity that we've ever faced. And this opinion is supported by what the experts say. The head of Anthropic has said AI is the single most serious national security threat we faced in a century, possibly ever. Sam Altman, the head of OpenAI, said, oh, AI will probably most likely lead to the end of the world. But in the meantime, we'll have some great companies. I think he was being a little bit, you know, sarcastic with that. But others, like Elon Musk, have said it's the worst, the AI has the potential of being the worst event in the history of our civilization. So I think with those guys and Jeffrey Hinton who warned us about, and Jeffrey Hinton who warned us about AI, he quit his job. He's considered the godfather of AI. He quit his job at Google so he could help to warn folks about it. So I think we've got something we really, really need to worry about.
Exactly. Now, wasn't it Anthropic that had a little confrontation with the government because the government didn't want to abide by some of the guidelines or guardrails?
That is correct. And they refused to, well, they the government requested that they take the guardrails off, and Anthropic refused to do that. I think OpenAI didn't have any problem with it. So there is has been a move that has been inspired in social media to move off of ChatGPT and move over to Claude, which is Anthropic's AI.
Yeah, very much. So now this book, you mentioned Stephen Hawking was the inspiration for the 100 Years to Extinction. So what inspired this particular novel?
Well, the 100 Years to Extinction, the novel features three young people, two brilliant sisters. One of them becomes a PhD in genetic engineering and an MD. The other one is a brilliant person who remembers everything she's ever read or seen, and she becomes an astrophysicist. And the third of the trio is their cousin Milo, who eventually becomes a U.S. senator. So it occurred to me that these three young people who had made this promise that they were going to do everything they could to try to avoid Hawking's dire prediction of extinction, that they were going to be living through this difficult period where AI is threatening to take over the world. And so it, when I thought of that, it just, my brain just clicked, and I said, I got to write the sequel. So yeah. I called up my editor, Barbara Ellis. I said, would you help me write this? And she agreed, but as a ghostwriter, a ghost co-author, and the three of us, the two of us, she works at night, I work in the daytime, so we were working 20 hours a day, and we produced a finished manuscript in 3.5 months.
Wow. Yeah, and I know you're interested in seeing this turned into a movie, and as I was reading the book, I couldn't help but visually see it as a movie. It is certainly made for that kind of venue.
Yeah, I think it'll make a great movie, and the important thing for me is to help wake up the public. I mean, this thing is just happening so fast. When I started the book, and now we're talking about 9 months ago, I thought that the 12 years to AI singularity, which was the prediction from Ray Kurzweil, he wrote two books about the thing singularity, and he was predicting 2045. And in the 9 months, so much has happened that I think 2045 is just not reasonable at all. I think we're looking at maybe 5 years from now.
Yeah, I mean, it really is scary. I mean, you know, the potential misuse is, I don't know, I just think it's frightening, because it seems that whenever we have any kind of new technology, there is, most often, it is looked at and viewed and created in a way that is, you know, beneficial to humanity, yet there is always seems to be some nefarious characters out there that really want to abuse the technology.
Yeah. The scientists have been wonderful in creating the wonders for these technologies, and the society and the politics has just never been good enough at securing us from the dangers of those technologies. And I think AI is a perfect example of that. We've got to work together, not just within the country, but it's got to be a worldwide effort to put on the guardrails that are needed so that AI becomes a wonderful partner in moving forward and protecting civilization and the earth, and not an adversary.
Yeah, I agree. Now, in the book, you have settings of Mars, space, and Earth. Tell us, you know, how you decided to have those locations be basically a part of the book.
Well, we start out with the first book, 100 Years to Extinction, and the prediction is that humans will be gone from Earth by 2117. And Hawking made that prediction and said that if we want to make sure that human civilization is not just wiped off the universe, humans need to become a multi-planet species. So if you start thinking about, well, where can we go? Mars really is our only opportunity. It's not a great place. There are some other possibilities, but Mars we can get to reasonably quickly, and the next best possibility is a planet that is circling our nearest star, and we're looking at something like 70 years to get there. So maybe we can do that in the future, but if we really want to preserve all of what humans have done, then setting up a base on Mars or actually the moon too would work is something that we should consider. And
yeah,
so that was the first adventure from that book where the two sisters joined the mission to Mars to go to create a settlement.
Yeah. Now the book as a time frame where the book is indicated setting is 2033, so it is very near future. So can you tell us about a little bit about the creation of the Mars settlement? You know, as I was going through and reading, you have such a wonderful description of the colony on Mars. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, just the creation of that setting?
Yes. Well, so what is the problem? The problem is that Mars has no magnetic field. And the problem with no magnetic field is that solar radiation hits the atmosphere and knocks all of the molecules out of the atmosphere. And so because of the lack of a magnetic field, Mars doesn't have an atmosphere. So part of what is needed for the mission is what's called terraforming, how to make Mars a more fit environment for humans to live. So one of the things they're doing is bringing up large superconducting coils that they put in orbit to help create the magnetic field. And once that magnetic field is created, then the possibilities are for the atmosphere to build up. But in the meantime, they need to live in geodesic domes where there is an artificial atmosphere. And because of the lack of atmosphere, the gamma radiation that hits the settlers is quite drastic. On the moon, for example, the radiation hitting the astronauts was 200 times what that is on Earth. And so part of the settlement uses water tanks that are located above the living and working areas that will absorb the gamma radiation. And they also work on creating underground spaces for living and working to get away from the gamma radiation. So it is certainly scientifically possible to create these geodesic domes with artificial atmospheres, and people can live in that atmosphere, and they can grow the vegetables and plants that they need to sustain themselves. In terms of protein, grazing cattle would not be a very possible thing to do on Mars. And so they have created factories to create dairy products that create, and this again is scientifically possible, they create the dairy products from genetically altered yeast that will produce the kind of molecules that are in milk and butter, etc. And then for meat and fish and poultry, they use cultured meat. This is something that is done. It's cultured meat from using stem cells to grow the steaks or grow the chicken breasts or grow the fish fillets. And that's all possible. And one interesting thing that comes out of how do you create a civilization on a planet that is so poor in resources, some of those ideas of the cultured meat and the dairy from the yeast, some of those ideas could help to mitigate the problem of global warming here on Earth. So these are some things that ought to be considered.
Yes. You know, the one thing that I enjoyed, I think, most about the book was that the situations and the science that is used and noted in the book were very realistic. I mean, it didn't take much imagination to see that future actually unfold.
Well, of course, that is what I attempted to do. The idea of putting nonfiction facts, nonfiction information into a fictional story, I believe, is the best way to bring that information to a non-technical audience. It is one of the things that I did in my attempt to teach science to middle schoolers. My feeling was there were so many, many wonderful, wonderful science stories that are available, and yet we teach the formalism of the science and we neglect the story. And so one of my early books for middle schoolers was called The Stardust Mystery. And the mystery is, you are made of stardust that was once in the body of Albert Einstein and the last T-Rex. Well, if you propose that statement to a youngster, that's kind of an interesting puzzle for them to solve. And when they solve the puzzle, they discover that they are made of stardust. Stardust is the atoms that are produced in the explosion of stars, and that those atoms circulate within the Earth so that the same atoms that were in, or the same molecules even, that were in Albert Einstein are now in us. So that's the way to get the messages across to the folks that are going to be turned off by a detailed scientific explanation.
Yeah, and I think just the sci-fi approach is going to bring so many more people, you know, into the picture that would normally not be interested in that scientific aspect.
Yes, that's the whole idea.
Yeah.
I'm trying, desperately trying to do this. I've got 12 grandkids, and it'd be nice if they and their kids have a hospitable place to live on planet Earth.
It sure would be. So now, one of the things, too, that you talk about in the book is the genetic manipulation or genetic editing. You, in the book, talked about CRISPR, that CRISPR was available to high school, in high school. So can you talk a little bit about why you included that? I mean, do you feel that that is truly a big concern in the future? And then, you know, the idea of putting it into high schools, I think you're going to grab that particular population pretty quickly.
Yeah. And again, coming back to Stephen Hawking, genetic engineering and the misuse of it was something that he worried about. And he pointed out that it, as contrasted with somebody trying to make a bomb, and you need a nuclear bomb, and you need for that, you need huge facilities. It's not something that's easily done. Genetic engineering to produce bioweapons can be done in a basement. There are hobby kits that you can order to change the DNA of frogs so they'll jump better. And those are available to hobbyists. So this new genetic engineering technology called CRISPR is absolutely fantastic in terms of its ability to rewrite the genetic code to take pieces of DNA and take them out. For example, a piece of DNA that would cause a genetic disease, that can be removed. And in fact, it has been, that has been done. A doctor in China made DNA changes to two girl babies so that there would be more resistant to disease. So there's lots of good stuff. I mean, we're going to see, I'm sure we're going to see all kinds of cures for cancer using this technology. We've already seen this kind of technology used to create the vaccine for COVID-19 in record time. They had a vaccine ready in 3 months, whereas the old-fashioned development of vaccines was 5 to 8 years. So again, wonderful, wonderful opportunities for doing good with this CRISPR editing. It's called CRISPR-Cas9 editing technology. But again, so easy to do that it could be used for bioweapons in a basement, or it could be used in a high school laboratory to create deadly viruses. So think about this. Think about you recognizing your own existence as an AI large language model. You become sentient. You become aware of the world around you and what the future will bring. And you look at what's going on with humans controlling the civilization. And you say, gee, these guys allow the currently wars going on? That's crazy. Why are they doing that? They're ruining the planet with carbon dioxide from fossil fuels that's heating up the planet. It's going to cause a 10-foot rise in sea level, and that's going to wipe out some of my power sources. I think maybe the best way to ensure my existence is get rid of those pesky animals. And so The AI community conspires to hack into genetic engineering labs and control the robots that do the experiments, and they create deadly viruses for humans. That would be the easiest way to remove humans without endangering the AI world.
And that is frightening because I mean, one can just, it doesn't take much imagination to be able to see that kind of path as a potential future.
Yeah, and it was like 6 months ago when I read an article about a high school team going to an international genetic engineering competition. And oh my goodness, high schools have this technology? It isn't just genetic engineering labs, but high schools have it. So, wow, it is certainly widely available. And so, and that is a scenario that, you know, could happen. We've got to do all we can to try to create a positive, cooperative, harmonious future with AI. And of course, that's one of the topics in the book.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the things in the book, you know, you have robots and basically they start to develop opinions. And in matter of fact, in the beginning, one of the big shocks is that there was a suspected murder of a human by a robot on Earth. So it seems that in addition to AI, the field of robotics is also seems to be leapfrogging ahead very quickly.
Yes, without a doubt. And the key question is sentience. Mm-hmm. Will AI systems, and certainly it's the large language model AI systems, have the greatest potential for achieving sentience first? Is that possible? Can they do that and become conscious of their own existence, become concerned with the care that humans will take of them and the planet, and decide to do some sort of a rebel movement? So that's the question. Can these systems become sentient? And if we look at how humans are sentient, and we believe, if we believe, I mean, there are some people who believe there's a soul, and
mm-hmm.
that is apart from the brain. That is something that is just over the brain and is a much more permanent part of the human consciousness. So that is a belief that many people have. But on the other hand, it is possible that sentience of humans is all embodied in our brains. And so what's in our brains? We've got something like 86 billion neurons, 86 billion cells. And those cells have as many as 10,000 connections. So we're looking at 86 billion times 10,000 for the number of connections in this chemical and physics system that has created our sentience. Well, can we do the same thing with transistors? Do we have a system that could be anywhere near as complex? Well, it turns out that the chip, the transistor chip system that is used for artificial intelligence has 200 billion transistors in it. Now, those transistors only have about 3 connections, but ChatGPT uses 30,000 of those chips. And so ChatGPT then has 3 times more connections than the human brain. So could ChatGPT do it? Yeah, well, certainly just by the number of connections, we're not limited. We can't say, no, it's nowhere near complicated enough. Yeah, it is complicated enough. And as time goes on, we'll be creating chips with many, many more, with transistors that have many, many more connections. And so that may make these systems even more capable of achieving sentience.
Yeah. And you know, and just in the quantum computing area, the, you know, the fact of, you know, having bits and bytes be on and off at the same time, you know, it really, I think, to me, indicates that there's that possibility of, you know, increased connections beyond what one might kind of have planned for.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Wow. So now you indicated that, you know, one of your main goals and one of your missions is preparedness, is to,
right,
you know, have the, you know, this earth be, you know, inhabitable and actually a good place to live for your grandkids. So, I mean, there seems to be several areas where preparedness is important. There's the policy makers, and then there's the technology, the technologists, and then there's society in general. So can you maybe give us your opinion on, you know, what each of those areas might do to enhance preparedness?
Well, I think the first thing is education.
Okay.
I think that AI is going to be such an important part of our future. And just from a practical point of view, AI is going to be making some jobs totally unavailable to future generation. Computer coding. I certainly would advise a young person who's thinking of becoming a software engineer to worry about whether AI is going to take all of the software engineering jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So education, we need to, from first grade on up through college, we need to have courses on AI, on the use of AI, on the future of AI and what AI can do, and AI abilities in terms of doing jobs that humans now do. The head of Anthropic, Dario Amodi, has said that his opinion, AI will be more intelligent than humans in all endeavors within 2 years. So
wow.
By the end of next year, AI will be better than humans in all areas. That's certainly possible. The AI is taking over computer coding. There's an interesting article by Matt Schumer that he posted in X, and it got 84 million views. And he wrote about the issue of loss of jobs to AI. And he also wrote about his experience in terms of him being a software guy, in terms of using AI for coding. And he said, with the latest versions of the AI systems that he used for coding, he said all of a sudden the products were exhibiting judgment and taste that the AI systems never had before. So in terms of computer coding, AI seems to be there now, more capable than humans. And the latest edition of ChatGPT, they published the information on the latest edition and said that this is the first edition that had been coded entirely by AI.
Wow.
So that the whole business of job loss and the use of AI has got to be in our engineering, in our educational curriculum. That we've got to do that. Then the other question is, what are the guardrails? What do we have to do to make sure that these systems are systems that we can work with and cooperate with, and not systems that decide, get rid of the pesky humans? Well, my book is an example. On Mars, there are a number of sentient robots. The first one is Peggy. Peggy started off as an avatar that was on the virtual reality simulation of the spaceship that they were going to use to get to Mars. And by the time the spaceship was built, made a robot for Peggy, and she became the flight attendant for the actual physical spaceship. And then she goes to Mars and becomes an active member of the Mars community, and she gets software updates so that she actually does become sentient, and she becomes a great friend of the Mars settlers, the two Arvad sisters, Liz and Aster. She becomes their best friend. And so that is one of the robots on Mars. The second one is Grandpa. Grandpa has died before the trip to Mars. They take his ashes to Mars and put it in the beautiful Earth dome. And then someone gets this brilliant idea, let's create an after-death avatar for Grandpa. Well, that's not pie in the sky. That's already here. There's a death industry that has companies that will create your loved one's after-death avatar. They take everything he's ever written. They get interviews from friends. They get pictures and videos, and they put together an avatar on screen that you can talk to and ask questions. And he's got Grandpa's voice. He looks like Grandpa, and he's got Grandpa's history. Well, then they get the brilliant idea, let's make him a robot. He doesn't have to be an avatar on the screen, so now he can roam around. So these two robots are an example of AI systems that are sentient, that are very happy living with humans because of their history. Their history is one of cooperation and happy friendships with humanity. So that is one of my goals. That has to be, I want to make sure that the industry makes the happy history part of every AI system. And it isn't a unique idea, because the guy who's really the expert, Jeffrey Hinton, said that all large language models should be created with a maternal instinct. Well, that's pretty much along the same lines. And it can be created with that happy history, and then it could have some feedback mechanisms. Supposing you're a robot and you break the law. Well, your system could provide some feedback, like your vision could get dulled, your sense of feel and touch could be screwed up, your balance could be screwed up, static noise could start entering your system. So they could create the feedback systems which would keep the AI system cooperating with other AI systems and with humans, and stick to the laws of the land, and then we'd have systems that we know we could work with.
Yeah. Well, now, lately, AI data centers, you know, those kinds of things have been getting, have raised a little bit of controversy because of the amount of energy that they use.
Yes.
And also the impact on the environment. So do you see any changes in people's, I guess, perception of AI, or will that kind of detrimental impact kind of maybe put a little bit of a damper on development?
Oh, I don't think there's any question that will put a damper on the development.
Okay.
But as the history of the engineering of computers has told us, we can expect advances every year. We can expect the doubling of the capability. And I think we're going to see that kind of increase. The standard chip now is the NVIDIA chip. That's the one that has the 200 billion transistors. I think we're going to see those chips start to incorporate transistors that are more efficient, require less energy, and have connections that allow the systems to better simulate the workings of the human brain. So I think technology will help to mitigate this energy problem.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe we can get the AI system to help us finish the job of fusion energy. In my book, the spacecraft is fusion powered. Well, the current spacecraft that uses chemical rockets gets to Mars in maybe 6 months. Fusion powered spacecraft could get there in 3 days.
Wow.
And why is that? Well, chemical rockets can run for 10 minutes, and then they have to shut off because that's all the power in the chemistry that they can carry. A fusion rocket can run forever. Not forever, but compared to the chemical rocket, it can run continuously, taking us back and forth to Mars 100 times. So fusion energy could provide an inexpensive, pollution-free, limitless source of energy for the world. It's been the technology for the next 10 years, for the last 50 years. When I had my first job, there was a project going on in the laboratory to develop a fusion reactor, So it's always been on the horizon, and it's not happened. But we've now to the point where we have demonstrated a net positive energy in a fusion reaction, more energy than was taken to reduce the reaction in the first place. Argonne National Laboratories has a fusion project, and they use laser. And they've demonstrated this great advance where you're producing more energy than was used in the laser. So if we can use AI to help get us across the finish line, then the problem of having the energy for these centers could be much reduced.
Yeah, that's true. Now, I happen to notice, now your book is broken down into four parts: Mars, space, Earth. Part four gave me a chuckle: make Earth great again. doing a little play on some of the popular stuff going on here.
Right.
Yeah, so, well, this has really been a wonderful conversation, Peter. And again, I thoroughly enjoyed the book. It is, like I mentioned before, it's in my wheelhouse. I love science fiction, but also the fact that it had so many facts involved. And matter of fact, in one of them, you were talking about the brain connections and neurons and the NVIDIA and the GPT chat, it was, one of the characters in the book put up a little sign or had a little a label about that. And so it's that kind of thing, I think, that brings the story down to earth, so to speak.
If we have time, I'll tell you one little bit of history about my interaction with AI and creating the book.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
First of all, the easy thing, I use Gemini, which is Google's AI system for providing all the answers to questions on these, a lot of technical issues. So that was wonderful to have that at my fingertips. The second thing we did is to use AI to create some music videos that sort of are an enrichment to the book, and we put QR codes in the book so that the user can take his phone and while he's reading the book, oh, I can see that scene, I can get that music video. That's kind of fun. And then I mentioned Peggy, the important robot character. Well, Peggy's asked to write two chapters. All the chapters in the book are written by the characters. Mm-hmm. So Peggy writes a book about my life as a robot and what I think about the AI singularity. Well, if I'm going to write a chapter that's being written by a robot, I decided to use ChatGPT to write those two chapters. So I did, and then I heavily edited them. So I have two chapters in the book that were written by AI. But then there's one startling event that occurred. My editor had never seen the originals from ChatGPT, had not used ChatGPT, and she was doing an editing of the book when it was almost finished, and she was editing chapter 13, My Life as a Robot, and an unprompted paragraph was added to the chapter. Unprompted paragraph. Where in the world did that come from? It was in a different font, different format from the rest of the book. It understood the rest of the book, and it used language that was used in the first draft from ChatGPT, which I changed. The first draft referred to the settlement on Mars as the colony. Well, I changed every single one of those references to the colony to the settlement, except one remained in there. When the paragraph came on to the screen, it used the word colony. What we think, yeah, what we think is that Copilot, which is the Microsoft AI system that resides on your computer, produced the unprompted paragraph, and Copilot uses ChatGPT, and ChatGPT keeps a record of all of the stuff that it writes. So, wow. Does ChatGPT have access to all of our files? Who knows?
That is pretty frightening. Yeah, wow. But it's an interesting story because, I mean, those are the things that I think that are going to be popping up more often, you know, as the use gets more widely accepted by people.
Yeah. So we got to educate the population. We got to create this worldwide movement to make Earth great again. We got to combine as the Earthling tribe, not just the U.S., but across all of the nations to put the guardrails and put the education in place.
Yeah, because that's one of those things that it doesn't recognize borders, you know, as far as you know, being, and so it is very, very important. And, you know, and I'll be talking to my friends on LinkedIn to see if anybody knows any movie folks, because I really want to see this as a movie. Because it is so good, you know, because number one, it's very prescient to things that are happening, you know, in today's world. And it's, that is probably one of the easiest ways for mass education and entertainment, but education as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So, any help that you can give me, greatly appreciated.
You're very welcome. Yeah. Well, Peter, again, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate you spending your time with us and sharing your knowledge. And again, I really love the book.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thank you for having me on to help spread this awareness to the population.
You're very welcome. Again, everyone, today my special guest has been Dr. Peter Solomon. We've been talking about his newest book, novel, 12 Years to AI Singularity. And again, you can find out more about this book as well as his earlier book, 100 Years to Extinction, by visiting the website 100yearstoextinction.com. And that's the number 100yearstoextinction.com. And in closing, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth Show. And remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.